human genomes are 99.9% identical, with one prominent exception. Instead of a matching pair of X chromosomes, men carry a single X coupled with a tiny chromosome called the Y. Using methods from history, philosophy, and gender studies of science, Sarah Richardson examines in her new book, Sex Itself, how gender has helped to shape the research practices, questions asked, theories and models, and descriptive language used in sex chromosome research. Sarah Richardson is assistant professor of the history of science and of studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard University, and we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
It is a pleasure to have you with us. The name of the book, Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. What got you on this line of thought?
Well, we're entering the genomic age, and we just a few years ago finally sequenced the X and Y chromosomes, known as the sex chromosomes, which were discovered a little over 100 years ago. And the release of the sequence of the X and Y led me to wonder, how have these vivid biological symbols of maleness and femaleness transformed our understanding of the biology of sex over the past 100 years, and how have they trafficked between scientific research and popular conceptions of masculinity and femininity?
So how much is science and how much is intuitive then?
Well, I have an understanding of science as a social practice where scientists are human and social creatures who use the models and metaphors of the day to make sense, if you will, of suggestive facts, but facts that have to be organized in some coherent script or narrative to make sense in our human world. And so I think that intuition, as you call it, or language, metaphor, is all a part of normal scientific practice. And gender just provides one really great example of how that occurs.
So when it comes to the genetic science of sex, there is what we know and what we believe, right?
Well, that's one way of thinking of it. I like to think of science as a set of debates or contestations. There is what we know, right? And over time, we can say we know more. We've
learned
a lot about the evolution of the X and Y chromosomes, the genes that are on them, and their role in overall human development, as well as specifically in sex. But at the same time, there's a big difference between facts and theories. And at the level of theory, we are doing cognitive work to organize those facts into theories that make sense. And there, we're drawing on our intuitions about maleness and femaleness to try to order these facts. So it's true that we know now a lot about the science of the X and Y, and I'd be happy to get into that with you. But we still have to do a lot of reasoning from there to try to connect it to our everyday experiences of maleness and femaleness.
So when it comes to the dialogue and how cultural conceptions of gender operate within the science of sex, what should that dialogue be then?
Well, I give some examples in the book of problematic conceptions of the X and Y, lots of examples of how we've tended to think of the X as the female chromosome and look for female traits on it and even think of it as behaving in a feminine way, and similarly the Y as the male chromosome. And I also look at the way that scientists have continually looked to the X and Y to try to find the real, the essence, the material basis of maleness and femaleness. And I try to situate this as part of a really long search in science for the biological basis of sex differences, one that has continually used the technologies of the day to try to quantify and localize those differences, but which haven't always also looked at the similarities between the sexes, which I think is really one of the most provocative results of contemporary genomic research, and the variation within males and within females and the overlap overlap between them. So I do think that we need to have a really strong critical, ethical, historical, and social conversation about the way this new technology is framing the science of human sex differences.
How does it come in ethically?
Well, I think that, science is not apolitical, especially the science of human differences. There's a long history, as you'll know, of science being used to argue for the inferiority of women or merely to suggest that sex differences are fixed, natural, in such a way that the goals of a gender-equal society cannot really be achieved. And this science of sex differences, even in 2013, and even with our most elite science, genomics, enters into that echoing hall of ideas about the essence of male-female sex differences. And so, yes, I think that it is at once an ethical discussion about the potentiality for plasticity in gender, and it enters into all sorts of highly relevant debates about that are, driving through our political debates today, such as about gay marriage, about how to raise transgender kids, and all of these issues.
So we don't want to make this black and white in the sense of you have two X's or an X and a Y. We can have an XXY, we can have an XYY, we can have an XXYY. There are, as you noted, there are many variations.
That's right. So one of the really fun and easy ways to look at how scientists have applied their gendered cognitive schemas to interpreting the sex chromosomes is to look at these conditions called sex chromosome aneuploidies, or cases where there's an unusual number of sex chromosomes.
I'm sorry, so what was that last word you used? What?
Aneuploidies.
All right. Now,
sorry to get too science.
Now, Sarah, tell me what that means.
It means numerical disorders. So
okay.
You have an extra number, or perhaps a reduced number, of sex chromosomes. Now,
okay.
All of these conditions are compatible with life, and they do not necessarily produce intersex individuals. But there are ways in which, in initially interpreting individuals who have an extra X chromosome or who have an extra Y chromosome, scientists assumed that the extra X or Y was like an extra dose of femaleness or maleness. And over time, we've learned that those initial presuppositions were false and, in fact, led to stigmatization and an ignoring of the real medical conditions often associated with these extra chromosome disorders. But yes, so you can have extra chromosomes, sex chromosomes, that is, and this can be totally compatible with a normal sexual phenotype. And that tells us something interesting about these special chromosomes. If you have an extra of any other chromosomes, you're going to have some pretty severe disorders. But with the sex chromosomes, lots of arrangements are compatible with life, which fits with a picture of sex as something that has multiple routes to normal or compatible with life sexual phenotypes.
So I don't want to read into this too much, but is there a difference between an intersex condition and intersexuality?
Ah, well, so an intersex condition is any condition that involves some combination of male typical and female typical traits, usually at the level of the gonads, right, and the genitals.
Right.
And so, yes, there is a difference between specific intersex conditions, I would say, and an identification, right, a gender identity that is intersexuality, right? So I would would say that we're dealing with a complex concept there with multiple levels of analysis, right? You can look at sex and gender biologically at the chromosomal and genetic level, at the gonadal, testes and ovaries, at the genital level, morphological level, but then also at the level of sexual orientation, gender and sexual identity, and some people would even say brain sex, right? And so once we enter a discussion of intersexuality, we're talking about multiple layers and dimensions of human identity and experience.
Given the complexity, and my takeaway from the book, and I'll admit my takeaway from the book of what I understood completely, is that there is, we've learned a lot over history, and yet there is still a lot more to learn.
So, although I'm a historian and philosopher of science, and so I tend to think of science as not just on a progressive accumulating track toward total knowledge, but in fact as proceeding through a variety of moments that are at once cultural and very theory-laden with language and the technology of the moment.
So you're not left with question marks?
What's that?
You're not left with question marks?
Oh, I am, and I think it's going to be quite exciting what we find out in the future. But I do think we always have to interpret that within a human frame.
Okay.
And that there's a way in which the conversation is not going to go away. It's not as if we are going to be able to settle the debate about sex in some neutral, apolitical way by looking to the facts of science.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's called Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. Sarah Richardson, I thank you very much for being with us. I wish you a lovely holiday season and a great 2014. Thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
A delight. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.